It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Folks, the people of this nation have spoken. They've delivered us a clear victory, a convincing victory, a victory for we the people. We've won with the most votes ever cast on a presidential ticket in the history of the nation, 74 million. What I must admit has surprised me. Tonight, we're seeing all over this nation, all cities and all parts of the country, indeed across the world, an outpouring of joy, of hope, renewed faith in tomorrow, bring a better day. And I'm humbled by the trust and confidence you placed in me. I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify. Who doesn't see red states and blue states, only sees the United States.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That seems oh so long ago, but it was just in this last week. But the problem is, of course, Joe Biden is claiming victory when he actually only has, and nothing is certified. He doesn't really have any electoral votes until it's been certified. Only 259, not 270. I want to make that clear before we even start this discussion. Nevertheless, we know that Joe Biden is making calls. Ben Rhodes has told us that he's making calls to world leaders. We've had Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron from France congratulate him and others, but not everyone. In fact, not China. And we're going to talk about what this means to communist China. What, in fact, does it mean? I've asked our next guest to join us. He's actually in East Asia right now. It's Grant Newsham. He's a retired U.S. Marine Corps officer, a former U.S. diplomat. He is the senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies and also for the Center for Security Policy. Grant, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the invitation.
Grant, you are you're based out of Japan, at least when you're in that part of the world, and you're there now, right, in Japan?
Yes.
I would be really curious to know. Let me just tell you that I spent, 3 weeks in Japan a number of years ago and was in five cities. I was a singer at the time. But I was with the Japanese people, and I love them, by the way. I love the culture, and I think the food is beautiful. And so I have a real fascination with Japan and a love for the Japanese people. And I'm curious to know how they are responding to the possibility that Joe Biden may be the next president of the United States?
Well, like a lot of countries, it depends on who you talk to. And the area that I focus on most is obviously foreign affairs, military affairs. And what you find if you actually dig below the surface a bit and you ask around a bit is there is some real concern that the Biden administration would be soft on China. And that is a real worry for many Japanese who give security matters thought. And even in the government, you will find that, of course, nobody is actually going to pick a fight with the United States. So whoever it looks like is going to be president, they're going to hedge their bets and say the right things. But if you get below the surface, in large parts of Japan's foreign affairs establishment, establishment, there is real concern that it will be a return to the Obama days of appeasement and even the George Bush era, which was not nearly as tough on China as it needed to be. Because Japan is obviously just across the water from China, The Chinese are looking to pick a fight with Japan and teach them a lesson. So there is an awareness, a deep awareness, even if unspoken, to foreigners at least, that there's some reason for concern with the Biden administration. I would note the Japanese worry about every new administration. But in Japan, as you know, it's always good to look below the surface to see what the real situation is.
You know, I think it would bear repeating or expanding on this. And that is, as you know, because you're an American, Americans are not really cognizant or aware of just what a threat China is to that region. So kind of explain that to us. Why is Japan so concerned about China? Why, you know, any of those countries, India too, but they're not in East Asia. But what's the concern with them, and how much of a threat does China actually pose to them?
Well, the concern is that China will dominate the region, and that domination can be physical. As you see, the Chinese have effectively got control of the South China Sea now. They are just as happy, however, with psychological domination, the ability to intimidate another country, other people, so that the Chinese don't even have to play rough. The other side knows that if they step out of line, if they say the wrong thing, write the wrong thing, that China will punish them. And it is that fear of Chinese domination that really is, you'll find it throughout the region. And the Japanese in particular, it's a historical matter, but in recent histories, say going back 150 years, the Japanese have had the upper hand on the Chinese, and the Chinese are now looking to pay the Japanese back. They say it very clearly. You just have to listen to it. And they're waiting for the opportunity, and one imagines that that may come down in the Japan's southern territories, the Senkaku Islands that are down south past Okinawa near Taiwan. And that is this fear, say, of Chinese domination. You'll find it throughout the region. If you just look a little bit and listen, can the Chinese actually impose their will on the region? I'm afraid the answer is they're headed that way. In certain areas, they already can. I mentioned the South China Sea, but see Chinese influence operations almost everywhere. This can be economic, financial, but also the Chinese military has undergone the fastest, biggest military buildup, I would suggest, in history. They have gone from a fairly low base about 30 years ago to now being able to match the United States in certain areas and in certain conditions. So the idea that America is just unrivaled in Asia, those days are long gone. The Chinese military is able to take us on. And that is something that the experts all said could never happen. Well, it happened, and it was obvious at least 10 years ago that this is where we were going to find ourselves. So if America should be worried, you can imagine what the individual countries in Asia are worried about. So this is serious.
Grant, and it's fair to say, is it not? Look, I read and know a lot, but you're a military man, and you're right there. But my take on that is that the reason that China has been able to build up their military prowess is because they have stolen secrets, technology, or they've been given them by America, and they have been really funded by America through all the trade deals and all the manufacturing and all these businesses going to China. Is that an overstatement, or do you feel that's true?
I think that's true. It's probably a little, it's even worse. I'd say the U.S. military and some of its leaders have been complicit in this over the last 20, 30 years, falling over themselves to engage with the Chinese military, show the Chinese military there are capabilities, and to do joint training with them and exercises. This has been insane, and anyone who challenged this within the U.S. military was generally slapped down, and that's it's unfortunate. So the U.S. military has had a contribution there, and we do have to remember that this whole thing started a long time ago. You know, even one could say with President Nixon, but also President Reagan was handing over U.S. Torpedo and artillery shell manufacturing technology to the Chinese. Jimmy Carter did it as well. The idea was that if you accommodate them, they'll become friends. And this was insane then, and there's been no excuse for allowing this to happen, but it's continued. But the other thing I would mention is that we do talk a lot about how the Chinese steal technology, they can't innovate. That is just not true. Well, they do steal. They'll steal anything that isn't locked down. But it's that idea that the Chinese aren't smart as us. It's not as clever. And that has gotten America into a huge bit of trouble. The Chinese are just as clever as us. And with their ingenuity, they've been able to take what they've got, improve on it, and figure out how to use it. And they're working on creating a military that is able to defeat ours, that has the same capabilities and more. So one should not underestimate the Chinese in any respect. And there has been a condescension that one notes throughout the government, the military, academia, sort of a sense, well, the Chinese could never be as good as us. In the case of Wall Street, this has just been, I would say, craven treason. If you look at how the America's financial and business classes have fallen over themselves to invest money and technology and know-how into China, thinking that we're going to get rich. What the Chinese have done is use that technology, money, the foreign currency, to help build up their military, build up their economy into a force that rivals us and in some areas supersedes ahead of us. So you didn't understate things at all. I think there's, as I've got to get across, it's even worse than you let on. Yeah. The game's not over, but we'll see how this plays out.
Grant, just philosophically, certainly we've heard the notion that if we become friends with our enemies or do business with them, if we enter into trade agreements with them where they have something at stake and we have something at stake, we neutralize their motivation to attack us. So that's been the general idea. And I have to say that when it came to, now this, I speak like this is long in the past, I think it's just dormant right now, when the Islamic threat was more the topic of the evening news and more, you know, the headlines of what we were seeing in this country, I heard the same thing. I heard this from a top leader of the FBI. I sat next to him on the plane. And I argued with him about what the Islamists had in mind. And he said to me, no, we're going to bring them close. That's why we're letting him into the FBI buildings. That's why they're able to bring their prayer cloths and interrupt meetings, you know, by going over. Because we're bringing them closer so that we can keep an eye on them. And this will neutralize them. So, Grant, I ask you this. Has that ever worked? Is there any merit in that kind of philosophy from your perspective?
Well, maybe if you're dealing with the Canadians. But not with the people that we're worried about. And see, there's not a shred of evidence to suggest it does. And once again, it's a conceit on the part of some Americans who tend to look at the other people as children. You know, if you just humor them, we can shape them and bring them in the right direction. They don't really know what they're doing. But it's kind of dumb, actually. It's always useful to look at the nature of the other side.
Yes,
not everyone wants a good deal. Not everyone wants to be friends. There's some people who want what you have, who want to dominate you, want to defeat you.
And who are working you. And I'd say in terms of the Islamists and in terms of the Chinese, it's the same on both parts. They're so clever. They're so bright. They're always manipulating, always thinking ahead, actually thinking circles around us. And I agree with you. It's just the height of a superiority complex or just really stupidity. I'm not sure which. But let me just say that Grant has just written this article for the Asia Times called Biden Restoration Cause to Rejoice in Beijing. And we're going to get to that in just a second with our guest, Grant Newsham. So stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
When Xi Jinping talks about national rejuvenation, he's not talking about a party. He's not talking about having a really good day and a celebration. He's talking about the Middle Kingdom. He's talking about these central ideas of nationalism, Chinese nationalism, and the Marxist-Leninist underpinnings of his regime. He's dedicated to that. He's committed to it. He's put resources against it. They have a model that is highly developed of state-sponsored enterprises and their civil military fusion program. These are things Xi Jinping knows. And for an awfully long time, the West sat on its hands. We turned the other cheek. What I spoke about at the Nixon Library most clearly was a need to reorient and recognize that whatever the policy that were chosen back in the 1970s, whether they may well have made sense at the time, they no longer make sense for the security of the American people. This isn't just a security issue. This is a fundamental understanding about how economies grow and how we preserve jobs and wealth creation and prosperity here in the United States of America. This is central to the Trump administration's foreign policy. I believe it's going to be central to every administration's foreign policy for years to come.
Okay, that was the voice of Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State under President Donald Trump, who is, by the way, still president as far as I could tell. And so even though Joe Biden has declared victory, there is no victory yet. Nevertheless, the world is contemplating, you know, what might be happening. And China, of course, has a lot to lose, I say, if Joe Biden is the next president of the United States. Grant Newsham is our guest. He, again, is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies and also for the Center for Security Policy. Grant, I remember election night I was watching, and at one point, just a report came across that the Chinese yuan was dropping. There were two reports in that. There was like, this is unrelated, but well, sort of. The betting odds, against Biden winning had gone, everyone thought President Trump was going to win, including the New York Times. And, at the same time, the Chinese yuan was plummeting. What was that all about? Why would that be the case with the Chinese currency?
Well, with the Chinese currency, it's always a little hard to, not hard, you have to be careful with it because it's not really a convertible currency. But to the extent that people do trade in it, that gives you a pretty good sense of who the Chinese wanted to win. And they were expecting more trouble or more difficulty, or to put it in simple terms, they were expecting somebody to actually stand up to them if Mr. Trump remained as president. So I would suggest the Chinese were definitely hoping that Mr. Biden won the election.
So, Grant, and you, I know there's a lot to say about this, but if you are able to just give us a thumbnail sketch of the changes that Donald Trump has made in China policy in this last nearly 4 years, what would they be in regard to the Chinese?
Well, fundamentally, he moved America from a position, from a basic stance of de-escalation, of accommodation. The old word for that is appeasement. That had been American policy during the Obama administration, and unfortunately, going back every previous administration for at least the last 20 years. But during the Obama administration, the 8 years, and this was when the Chinese military really got beefed up, when the Chinese economy really picked up. That was the mindset, was if China does something, accommodate them, de-escalate, give them so-called off-ramps, and make the problem go away. So what Mr. Trump did was to actually stand up to China, say, no, we're going to take you on for your trade cheating. You're not going to play by your own set of trade rules. We're going to enforce the rules. He actually gave the military marching orders to be able to fight China. You could, during the administration, the Obama administration, you could not even refer to China as an adversary. And that's if you were in the military. Mr. Trump changed that, and now the military was reminded that its role in life is to be able to fight America's enemies or anyone who will harm us. And that's what the military sort of switched over to get back to what militaries are supposed to do. And you also did see, finally, people speaking up about the evils of the Chinese regime. And that never happened before. And that for those three things, the economic, the propaganda in the good original meaning of the word, the Defense Security Act, that the Trump administration actually just turned things on a dime. And this was the first time in my lifetime, and I've been old enough, that this is the first time an American administration has actually stood up for American interests when it comes to Asia and to the Chinese Communist Party. And that was a sort of a shock to the system. Not surprisingly, the Chinese didn't like it all that much.
Yeah. Well, a few things. The Wall Street's going crazy. So the market's going crazy. We also know that Wall Street was heavily invested in Joe Biden's presidency, not in Donald Trump's. Because they stand to make a ton of money if big business and business can be able to go back into China. There are no nasty, inconvenient tariffs and trade deals that hurt China. And so they stand to gain a lot of money. I kind of get that. I don't like it. And I do think it's trade. I think absolutely. I agree with you. It's treason to deny the safety of your country in order to make yourself rich. But I'm curious to know, from your perspective, Grant, as a former military person, why in the world would America's military leaders, and heaven knows that's all we've known for a long time, the Pentagon has been filled with, it's just been a cesspool of leftists who, and part of that is embracing China. What would be their motivation?
Well, first I would note that most military leaders are not quislings. I'm being a little funny, but most of them really are very good, and there's been no shortage of officers and others who do understand what the mission is, and they've tried to keep the flame alive. But that hasn't always been the case, and you really notice it during the Obama administration, and even before to a degree, that there's a certain type of officer who sees what it takes to get promoted, and if parroting this week on China, the appeasement of China line, if that's what's going to get you ahead, well, that's what you do. And they all think that, well, when the time comes, we'll sort of snap back and do what the right thing is, and you really don't. So you get a sort of political general, an admiral, who gets promoted through the system. And the good, really good ones, they're still there, but they have to be careful. And it's so human nature on display, the sort of thing the ancient Greeks would have understood. But nonetheless, it's contributed to putting us into a very, very dangerous position vis-a-vis the Chinese.
What do you say? I'm never quite sure about this. Gordon Chang, I interview Gordon pretty often, and he has said, at least in the past, that he felt like President Trump's policies had really devastated China's economy, at least that they were in danger, on the precipice. Is that your perspective on that?
Yes, it really was effective. You know, you do always hear this, it's a mantra, oh, tariffs didn't work. Well, ask the Chinese. The damage caused to the Chinese economy was immense. And one thing to consider, and people don't often think about it, is that because the Chinese currency is not convertible, that if China wants to buy anything, it needs American dollars or euros or Japanese yen. Otherwise, the Chinese currency is like old Confederate money. And so what the effect of Mr. Trump's policies was really to reduce the flow of foreign currency into China. And by definition, that causes the Chinese Communist Party a lot of trouble. Also, not being able to steal as freely as they could, not being able to buy foreign technology the way they could, that also it's had a sort of restricting effect on China's economy. So it definitely has had an effect. They could have done other things that were even more effective. But compared to everything that's come before, this is the first administration to actually cause the Chinese to break a sweat.
And so if Joe Biden does prevail in this fight, then would you say the opposite will be true? It will be business as usual in China, and China's economy will once again flourish?
You know, it's a prediction, but I would suspect that the Biden administration would not be as strict or as concerned about sort of having a comprehensive sort of strategy, at least restraining strategy towards China. Or another way to look at it is a strategy which really bolsters U.S. interests. I think there would be a weakening in what the U.S. has done and is doing to take on China. It's hard to say, but my guess is that given that many of the people who are in line to have foreign policy jobs in a Biden administration, they have track records with previous administrations, and you have to ask, well, which of them was successful in dealing with China? I don't know who that would be. And also, which of them were in office, were in positions of authority when the Chinese military was building up, when the Chinese economy was growing and really growing at our expense. Who was in power then? Well, they were. And so it's hard to imagine how they are going to suddenly come back into office and do things all that differently. One does hope that they've learned some lessons, but I don't think they'll be able to match the sophistication and the effectiveness of the Trump administration. So this is not good for us. It is better for Beijing, I would suggest.
One area we haven't even discussed, and that is technology, and especially on the 5G issue. That is something that President Trump, it took some time to persuade him, but he put the kibosh or stopped the Chinese from controlling, I can't explain the details, and you probably can, but of controlling our 5G capabilities. And explain, if you can, Grant, why that is so important that they not have control over that, and what you think the future will be if President Trump does not prevail.
Well, there's always an advantage to whoever has the latest technology, whoever controls it, both for commercial purposes, but also there's a security military aspect to it as well. It just comes to being the first out with a technology, one way to look at it. And that's what the Chinese are after, is to be the people who are what we used to be, or what we kind of still are, is to be the ones who have the leading technology, and if anybody wants it, they have to come to us and buy it. And also we can withhold it from them and cause them problems in that regard. And if you want to misuse technology, say to close down a country's financial networks, well, the prospects are there. So there's an advantage that comes from being the first out, the first to operationalize a technology, especially one that is used by everybody everywhere just about. So that's what the Trump administration has tried to do, is to prevent the Chinese from getting that lead by restricting technology exports, etc. And that's very much a battle that's being fought, and I'm not sure who's going to prevail in it. But if America doesn't, we're really going to have some serious trouble.
The other thing I think of, there's so much to say about China, I don't need to tell you, but one of the battles that I was involved in trying to fight was the Confucius Institutes, which have been established on colleges and universities in this country, and they really are infiltrators for the Chinese Communist Party, also ways of them controlling their Chinese students who are on those campuses. And we've been able to push that back quite a bit. I don't know if that's out of your area, of your bailiwick, but do you know anything about that to add?
Oh, yeah. The Confucius Institutes are really an effective form of political warfare by the Chinese Communist Party. You put in these really educational centers, but at the same time, you are propagandizing, you are conditioning Americans to the idea that, well, China is not a threat. China is just a good, nice country. You don't pay attention to organ harvesting, black prisons, concentration camps, the complete absence of the rule of law, seizing the South China Sea, threatening neighbors. Don't just ignore that, because you go to the Confucian Institute and you learn to speak Chinese, or you see a cultural show or such like. It is a very good way to condition a target to believe that you are not threatening when, in fact, your intentions are to dominate and take over the target. Very successful in that regard. The Trump administration has pushed back on this. Additionally, the Confucian Institute said they actually program for very young children in, say, elementary schools and that sort. So they're thinking, China's splendid place, nothing to worry about. When in fact it's not. And the Trump administration has pushed back on this and done some good work.
Grant, we just barely scraped the surface, but I really appreciate your expertise for the audience this morning, and I want to recommend, we actually didn't even get to the content of your article, Biden Restoration Cause to Rejoice in Beijing. It's with the Asia Times. We'll put the link on our Facebook page so that you can read it. And Grant, hopefully you and I can have another conversation sometime about your knowledge of that part of the world. Grant Newsham with the Center for Security Policy. Frank Gaffney, by the way, is coming up next to talk a little bit more about the threats that China poses. Grant, thank you so much, and God bless you and keep you safe over there. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
A new report from the Pentagon says China has already surpassed the U.S. in missile development and is well on its way to achieving its plan for military dominance by 2049. The president accusing China today of, quote, not playing by the rules and cheating.
China is spending the money we give them to build up their military. They take our money and they spend it on building airplanes and building ships and building rockets and missiles.
It's not just advances in China's Air Force technology and aspirations, but in the past year, China's Navy surpassed that of the United States for the first time. A year ago, China had the largest Navy in Asia. The new Pentagon report says it has the largest Navy in the world. China now has 350 warships and submarines, compared to 293 for the U.S. Navy. U.S. warships, many of them nuclear-powered, are far more powerful than China's. But the Pentagon says Beijing is increasing its shipbuilding for all naval classes.
We face eroding competitive military advantage. It is likely that China will seek to build a military that is equal to, or in some cases superior to, the U.S. military or the military of any other great power that China perceives as a potential threat.
The reaction from China was swift in state-run news editorials. Quote, fear-mongering over China has always been the Pentagon's trick to demand more appropriations from the U.S. Congress. A fabricated grave threat to world peace can also help Washington sell more weapons to its allies. The new report also says China will double its nuclear warheads over the next decade. U.S. intelligence says China has roughly 200 nuclear warheads right now. The U.S. military has roughly 3,800.
For context, China's defense budget is $178 billion compared to the U.S. defense budget, which is more than $700 billion. The United States, for instance, spends more on the military than the next 10 countries combined.
All right, that was Jennifer Griffin of Fox News, and that was several months ago when that report came out. But I just wanted us to put it in perspective how China has built up their capacity. We just had a great conversation with Grant Newsham about China and what the Biden election, what effect it might have on China. Frank Gaffney, of course, is the founder and executive chairman of the Center for Security Policy, a very good friend, as you know. He's heard on Secure Freedom Radio on this network every night. He also now does a television show called Securing America TV. And you can get that at you can find it online at securingamerica.tv. It's on from 5 to 6 each evening. And as you know, if you listen to Frank, he has the best information really anywhere on national security. And I've asked him to join us this morning. Frank, thanks for taking time this morning out of your busy schedule.
Oh, it's great to have a chance to visit with you, Sandy, always. Thank you.
So everyone hears you every morning on my show, for which I am so glad. I am so thankful every time I hear your voice, Frank, because you are the gold standard when it comes to letting us know what's happening. You've just written one of your commentaries. It's time to designate the Chinese Communist Party as a transnational criminal organization. Before we get into that content, Let me ask you your opinion. We have heard, you know, from the Democrats for the last 4 years ad nauseum what a danger Russia is to us. But is it true, on a scale of threats, is China not the biggest danger? Russia pales by comparison from my perspective. Is that true or not?
It is true. The Russians under Vladimir Putin have immensely built up their nuclear forces and done some modernization of other elements of their military, but they don't have much in the way of economic power. They certainly don't have anything like the global footprint that the Chinese have been building. The clear ambition that Xi Jinping has established, the dictator of China, to dominate the entire world. So I believe that China is a vastly more dangerous threat than any we've ever faced before in the history of our country, including in the darkest days of the Cold War with the Soviet Union.
So with that being the case, we are in a really, even though maybe most Americans don't even think about this, we are in really on a precipice with this election, because we are looking at a candidate who, even out of Grant's words a few minutes ago, the description how tough President Trump has been on China, and that's been a complete break from decades of American policy, to a candidate who, from what we can tell, Frank, has been very friendly to China. Maybe I could just have you describe how you would describe Joe Biden on the record, his history and policy and attitude toward communist China.
Former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, who worked closely with Joe Biden over a number of administrations, but specifically during the Obama-Biden years, said that Joe Biden's gotten every major foreign policy issue wrong, basically. And I think that's right. And most especially, he's been wrong about China. And during the time when he was the Obama-Biden administration's point man on China, he initiated or sponsored or otherwise advanced several of communist China's most important agendas to the great detriment of this country. The most obvious one is he was sent out to try to set things straight about the South China Sea and what the Chinese were doing to build these man-made islands. You may have talked with Grant about this, but they took pristine reefs in a number of places in the so-called South China Sea, and they turned them into fortified bastions with which to control the vital sea lanes and the underwater resources and the airspace of the South China Sea, through which, conservatively, I believe, $1 trillion worth of trade passes, and a lot of our national security interests as well. Joe Biden took a promise from the Chinese that they wouldn't militarize those islands at face value, as did Barack Obama. And, of course, those promises were not kept, and we now have a terrible situation out there where I think our vital interests and those of our allies are definitely at risk. But even more importantly, in a way, Sandy, it hasn't gotten nearly as much attention. It's not as obvious, but Joe Biden presided over in May of 2013 the negotiation of a memorandum of understanding between the Chinese Communist Party and U.S. authorities that essentially gave China preferential access to our capital markets. And by preferential access, I mean they didn't have to abide by our securities laws and regulations, which were essentially designed to protect investors. And consequently, they've taken something on the order of $3 trillion from those U.S. investors, and they've been applying it to all kinds of problems, including some that Jennifer Griffin was talking about a moment ago, this massive military buildup, but also the build-out of their colonial empire around the world, the so-called Belt and Road Initiative, their technology and intellectual property theft operations, their espionage, their influence operations, and a whole host of criminal activities And interestingly enough, tonight we're doing a webinar with the Committee on the Present Danger China at presentdangerchina.org. And it's looking into an issue that I think is of passing importance in terms of what we can do about this threat from China. Sandy, and that is we're going to be examining the criminal activity that the Chinese Communist Party has been engaged in, both against us, against others around the world, and frankly, against their own people, which will give rise, I believe, to not only the opportunity, but the necessity of President Trump's administration and whatever time is left to it, and I hope it's going to be 4 more years, but for whatever time it's got left, to designate the Chinese Communist Party as the transnational criminal organization that it is.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Sandy, that will make a huge difference. Yeah, go ahead.
All right, well, let's talk about that. Let's put some flesh on that, because the only thing that, look, just because I've not thought about this, I think of organ harvesting. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about when it comes to criminal acts? All right, so what do we know about what they're doing? We've heard about stories in China, but are they harvesting organs in other areas? I think I had heard that they were, was that there's something about North Korean refugees or something, but tell us what we know about that.
What we know is that there is an industrial scale operation in China, having through this massive state surveillance operation they call the social credit system and its kind of healthcare counterparts, having monitored the health, but taken the DNA, taken tissue samples, taken blood samples from everybody in China, including most especially people who are considered enemies by the Chinese, like the Falun Gong practitioners, like the Uyghur Muslims, like the Tibetan Buddhists, and others. They've got in their database the ability to find a match for oftentimes Western individuals who desire a transplant, and who come to the country of China for the purpose of getting, on an expedited basis, that organ, whether it's a kidney or a liver or a heart or a lung or what have you. These are the sorts of things that you can get on very short order, because they'll basically go out and kill somebody to get you the organ you need. And often, as I say, those are people that they are anxious to get rid of anyway. It's just that they can make money, quite a lot of money, actually, by harvesting their organs. I call it organ genocide, because harvest seems like it's a basically benign term.
Positive
it's
name, yes,
but.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, we think of the Wuhan virus, the China virus, the coronavirus. Now, you know that young Chinese, well, she looked young, Chinese doctor who came out, 3 months ago, 2 months ago maybe, and talked about how she had a front row seat. She is declaring that China unleashed that on the world intentionally. Now, I don't know what you know about that, what you think about it, Frank, but is that yet another example, you think, of a crime committed against, potentially, against the world?
Yeah, this is the most egregious crime against humanity in the history of the world. As our friend Gordon Chang has pointed out, it's the first time ever that one nation has attacked every nation on the planet. And it did so deliberately. Now, what I'm not certain of, I have a suspicion, and I think this Dr. Lin, I think her name is, testimony reinforces the suspicion, but it's still, the jury, I think, is out, that they manufactured this disease. They actually engineered it for the purposes of being highly contagious, lethal, but not so terribly lethal that it would, be clearly seen as a biological weapon. But they did it in a biological warfare facility in Wuhan, China. And it didn't just escape, I don't think. I think that they let it out. But whether they did or whether they didn't, what we know is that once it was out, Sandy, the Chinese Communist Party took full advantage of it as though it were a biological warfare attack against the rest of the world, and particularly against the United States. They wanted, unmistakably, and they've said so, they wanted to take down Donald Trump. And I think, interestingly enough, in October of 2019, as I'm sure you know, Sandy, there was a tabletop exercise conducted in all places in New York City to show what a coronavirus pandemic would do.
Oh my goodness, Frank.
Their interests.
There's the music. Where does the time go? All right. So the article is called, "It's Time to Designate the Chinese Communist Party as a Transnational Criminal Organization." And so Frank Gaffney is suggesting that President Trump do that, depending on whether he has a short time left in office or another 4 years, that it needs to happen. Because then, as I understand it, Frank, big companies cannot invest there. That is the point, right? We can't help them anymore financially.
They would be accomplices to a criminal activity. That's correct.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, so I think we at least got a chance to explain it, even if we didn't finish our discussion. Frank Gaffney, Center for Security Policy, and you should go to SecureAmerica.tv to watch his show at 5 o'clock. Sandy Rios in the Morning, AFR Talk.